This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Welcome, everybody, to the second edition of Pigskin Plinko. This is where we put together a roundtable panel, which features a member of the Orange Bloods staff, along with a media member that covers either the Longhorns or college football on a national level, which our guest today does, and then a poster from the Orange Bloods website, which is today Arlong 38, which I'm quite excited about because I don't know that I've ever heard Arlong 38's voice until this morning. And he's such a polarizing poster. Arlong 38, welcome to the show, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Ketchum. Just a correction. It's 68, but Arlong 68, but it's my pleasure to be on your podcast.
I never include the numbers. You're just Arlong.
Yeah, you're just known as Arlong.
Yeah. that voice is Jason Sukumel.
Sukumel knows me as something else, probably.
No, you're good.
All pet nicknames in the podcast go. But that's Jason Sukumel, managing editor of OrangeBloods.com. And then joining us, courtesy of The Athletic, Max Olson, who, of course, covered Texas for ESPN, but is now doing the national college football thing. You can follow him on Twitter at Max_Olson. And, of course, read his stuff over at The Athletic, one of the more inspiring news sites on the American sports scene. Max, thanks for giving us some time today.
Hey, what up? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So, real quick, before we get into the topics, how's everybody feeling about this week? This is interesting to have Texas and Oklahoma in a rematch for the Big 12 championship game. As this thing gets closer for me, I can't help but feel the weight of the stakes that are going to be in play on Saturday for both teams.
You know, it's a huge game, obviously, championship implications. Okay, I mean, that's the obvious stuff. But just the bragging rights, I feel like, you know, there's so much to gain, but I feel like there's almost more to lose for both teams in this game. I almost feel like Texas fans will hate losing this game more than they will enjoy winning this game, if that makes sense. I mean, this is the type of game, if you win, you celebrate it. Yeah, it's a huge win. You go into a big bowl game. But, boy, if Texas or Oklahoma, it's on their side too. If whoever loses this game, it's going to be salt in the wounds for a long, long time. And the closer it gets, I can't wait for it to get here.
Yeah, I feel – go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm excited. I'm excited about it. I do agree that there is a lot on the line for both teams. I think as a Texas fan, though, I'm going to give a slight nod to the fact that we've been wandering in the desert for, I guess, 8 previous seasons. And so a chance to get back on top of the Big 12, to me, I'm excited about it. I'm ready to roll the dice with this team, and I'm ready to go, and I'm ready to deliver another beating of Oklahoma, you know, a second time this season. So I'm ready for it.
Max, what do you think the national feel on this is?
Well, obviously Oklahoma, I think from their side, like, Oklahoma has everything to play for, right? I mean, like, Oklahoma has not just a chance to reach the college football playoff on the line, but they have Kyler's last chance to jump to it for the Heisman in on the line here. And so, to me, it's like all the pressure is on Oklahoma. Oklahoma, this is a team that has, won 3 straight Big 12 title games. They've played in this stage and big games like this a lot, and Texas hasn't. And I think Texas has to come into this one playing like a team that's got nothing to lose and playing like the team where all the pressure is on their opponent. And you know, you can't act like this is too big for them. You know what I mean? Because I think that Oklahoma is the one that probably should be feeling a little bit more nervous about that. Even if Texas being a dog again, I mean, I think that they just got to come out knowing, well, you know, we have a chance to make the New Year's Six Bowl no matter what. Let's just go, you know, play our butts off and see what we got here.
It feels so much chippier in the first few days of this Texas OU week than it did just a couple of months ago. And one of the topics that I think has led to, I don't know, a little bit of the chippiness, our first topic is completely UT-centric, and the options for people to vote for were the health of Sam Ehlinger, the situation with David Beatty helping the Texas coaches this week, and kind of David Beatty's potential future with the Longhorn program. The question of, is Texas overachieving, which Tom Herman, the last couple of weeks seems to bring up every time he talks to the media. And then just the importance of this week's game, which weirdly we kind of just spoke about. I thought the health of Sam Ehlinger would win, but no, at twice the margin, David Beatty and what he's doing this week with the Texas program and the coaches, it won out with over 40% of the vote. I think David Beatty's going to be working at Texas next season. I don't know in what role, but I think he may be Tom Herman's only friend, not at either U of H or Texas. Like I don't think Tom Herman has a lot of friends. I think David Beatty is one of the few. I mean, he told David Beatty last week after the game, "I love you." I don't feel like he says that every week when he runs into guys he knows. So it's an interesting deal because Herman made it out to be not a big deal, and Lincoln Riley seemed perturbed by it. Like he was like, "I wish that this thing hadn't happened." So Jason, I'll start with you. Your thoughts on what this is this week, and what you think the situation with Beatty will eventually become, should it become anything?
I got several thoughts on it. I mean, it's an interesting story, but I don't know that it's to me, a huge story. I was a little, like you, catch a little surprised that one kind of won out over more pressing things like Sam's shoulder or whatever. But, Tom, it was interesting to hear Tom Herman talk about it. He was asked about it on the Big 12 teleconference on Monday morning, and then at his press conference. And of course, our own Anwar Richardson was the first one to report on it. So, Tom kind of downplayed it, as you would pretty much expect. And he says, "Hey man, everybody does it. It's kind of self-scouting and that's fine. Maybe you make a phone call to do some self-scouting on a coach who's usually more maybe a non-conference coach that you played earlier in the year. Just a coaching buddy. Hey, do we have any tendencies that you saw that y'all were kind of picking up on?" But you don't usually try to fly the guy into Austin. Now, that ended up not happening supposedly because of the weather, I think was the last I heard. But, flying a coach down to Austin who just had coached his last game at his school, a coach that everybody's been talking about for the better part of 2 months, hey, can Texas get this coach on the staff somehow next year? Even before he got fired, Texas fans, he was a hot name to potentially be on the Texas staff next year. So, yeah, that was an eye-opener. And I tell you, I thought it was interesting. Lincoln Riley's response, I mean, it's setting a bad precedent or something to that nature is what he said. And then someone asked him, because his brother was a coach on the Kansas staff. And someone asked him, "Well, are you going to pick your brother's brain?" He said, "No comment." Well, of course he is. it's such a bullshit answer. I mean, it's just the nature of the business, man. Coaches try to get there's psychological edges they try to get any way they can. Obviously, schematic advantages. I mean, coaches try to get any edge they can. Tom Herman, I'll give him credit, man, and this Texas staff overall, they're pretty forward thinking on things like this. Or we saw in the recruiting realm last year when they sent Brian Carrington, they kind of found a loophole and sent Brian Carrington out on the road for a couple weeks. To me, get over it, Lincoln Riley. To me, I think it's a smart move by Tom Herman. I think Texas is going to need any and all advantages they can try to gain in this game. Texas is going to have to play their tails off, and Tom Herman's trying to find a way to ensure that happens. But I did find it pretty interesting catch. Like you, I think there's a very good chance that David Beatty is on this Texas either coaching staff or support staff in some capacity. I would put my money on that happening, just kind of a gut feel at this point. But you know, I did find it interesting the fact that they were trying to bring him down to Austin. Yeah, I know Anwar, you know, his sources told him, hey, it's quote unquote not a job interview. Listen, man, if you're coming down to talk X's and O's for a championship game, it kind of is a job interview. I don't care how you spin it. So a lot of interesting dynamics here, but I think it was a pretty smart move and kind of, like I said, forward thinking move by Tom Herman and whoever came up with it to get kind of David Beatty's opinion.
Max, it's a very Hugh Jackson going to Cincinnati kind of situation, isn't it? Like, it is, it's unusual that we would see this. You know, it's really interesting because Beatty just played both teams in back-to-back weeks. So there is no coach in the country probably better served to say what Oklahoma and Texas together in the month of November look like heading into this game than the guy that's seen them in back-to-back weeks.
Yeah, and you know, David Beatty's tenure at Kansas is one that I covered very closely, know him really well, you know, one of the best guys in the business. And I remember in 2016, when he got his first victory at Kansas in year two, I called him up and asked him, you know, how he celebrated that night. He told me he went home, I think he popped a bowl of popcorn, and he watched the replay of Tom Herman in Houston beating Oklahoma because that's Tom's his boy. And he was so excited for him. And that's just kind of the friendship they have. Like, these guys were together at Rice a long time ago, came up together and have stayed close throughout. So I wasn't surprised at all that David Beatty and Tom Herman were going to link up after the season and talk this stuff out. And, you know, it went further than that. I mean, Tom Herman talked to Clint Bowen, the defensive coordinator of Kansas. He talked to Kenny Perry, the special teams coach. I mean, this Kansas staff was at Tom's disposal this week. And, you know, last time now the sources I talked to told me he was in his luggage and bring him to Austin. And I think that would have been a lot more concerning, you know, for Lincoln Riley. I mean, look, it's all just self-scouting info. It's all just intel they're sharing with each other. And it's a very common thing in this industry. It really is. I mean, Tom Herman said he did the exact same thing with the USC staff after they played SC. They told him what they had on SC. SC told him what they had on Texas. And this is pretty common. So for Lincoln to say he didn't like the precedent, I understand where he's coming at. I mean, Lincoln has every right if he wants to go fly in six Big 12 coaches to help him beat Texas. But, you know, I wouldn't make that big of a deal of it. And honestly, like you said, I wouldn't be surprised if David Beatty and Tom Herman work together again in the future.
Arlong, you know what's interesting is when Mac was at Texas, it always felt like Stoops had an army of people with OU coaching ties spread out throughout the league, right? I mean, he was from the school of Bill Snyder, but you'd go to Texas Tech and you'd go to various outposts, and it felt like there were allies everywhere for Oklahoma, and it never felt like Mac really – you know, didn't have any of his guys really at any of the other schools. It is interesting to see the Texas even be in a position where it has a coach this forward thinking and the access to somebody who could help in this capacity.
I agree both with what Jason and Max said and the point that you're making. It does feel like there were a lot of times where Mac would tie his own arm, one arm behind his own back. And I think it's great that Herman's doing this. I agree. I don't really see the point of Riley making a big deal about it, other than the fact that, again, there was supposedly he was going to fly in and there was the whole wink, wink. Well, it's not a job interview. And I think a lot of us would make the assumption that it probably was pretty darn close to one. But I like it. I mean, coaches do it all the time. This is not a precedent. I would be obviously stunned if somehow this is the first time in a high stakes game where coaches didn't try to glean some glean some information from an outside pair of eyes for an opponent they got coming up. So, you know, everyone looks for an edge. There's nothing wrong with it. It's common sense. And again, said about Mac is that I'm glad that Herman is doing this. Hey, he's got a resource. He wants a fresh set of eyes going into a big game. Why not use it? I mean, you know, use it to your advantage. And there's nothing wrong with it. A lot of coaches, I imagine, do it. So I don't see any sort of big deal about it from the Texas standpoint. I wouldn't think it was a big deal if Oklahoma was doing it. Matter of fact, like you alluded to, I'd be a little more upset that, hey, how come we aren't doing it? How come we don't have
exactly
aren't using some sort of resource like that?
The biggest part of it, the fact that he was going to be on campus, if it was just a phone call, would anybody really care? But the fact that they were going to possibly bring him to campus, I think, is what made it more interesting, really.
Well, and exactly. I was under the impression that he met with his staff and said, hey, this being Herman meeting with his staff, like, I'm going to do this. Just want to let you guys know, you don't have to feel weird about it. Like, this is, I think, where the whole, it's not a job interview thing popped up. But it's fascinating for me because the first time I heard David Beatty's name was coming out of the 2010 season. Mack wipes out his entire coaching staff and builds from the ground up. And Beatty was a guy that wanted the job that Darrell Wyatt got. And from what I remember from 7-8 years ago was that there were people putting out feelers. Hey, because I remember somebody calling me and saying, hey, David Beatty wants this job. He's the OC at Rice, but he would take this job. He really wants it. I think I remember the person asking me, like, what advice would you give me? And I think my advice was, don't let Mack Brown know that you know my name and my number. That's the best thing you can do to help him out is to not let him know that there are any fingerprints connected to me. And Beatty doesn't get the job, but he ended up leaving, I think, going back to Iowa State for a year. And then he joins that Kevin Sumlin staff at Texas A&M. And for 3 straight years, he's the wide receiver coach and the recruiting coordinator and really had a big impact. And I just remember there had been a small push. Do you remember that, Arlong? Do you remember going that far back 7-8 years ago when Beatty's name first popped up? And then he ends up at A&M and doing the thing that people thought he could do at Texas. And then it feels like from the very moment he went to Kansas, there's been this thought, well, he'll eventually get fired. And when he does, he needs to come to Texas.
Yes, I do recall that. I'm able to remember that far back. And yeah, his name has been out there for a while. And even when he was at A&M, obviously his name was still a presence on the board in terms of rounding out future staffs and so forth. You know, regarding next season, you know, I don't know what his contract is. Is there at Kansas? I'm assuming that he's still going to be collecting some sort of paycheck from them next season. So really, even I think at a minimum, coming in as some sort of, you know, offensive quality coordinator type spot, he doesn't have to get paid a high salary. You know, Kansas is going to be footing the bill for it. It's a chance for him to sort of step away for a year, sort of reexamine and look at some opportunities going forward. And I don't think any of us are under the illusion that somehow there's not going to be any staff changes, perhaps maybe not after this season, but certainly after the next, you would think. I mean, that's just the nature of the business in this modern world, at least in my opinion.
You know, Max, go ahead.
Before that Kansas game, I talked to some Kansas reporters just to get some kind of some background for those matchup stories I do. And that was one of the things that one person told me, hey, wherever David Beatty lands, because I said, well, he'll probably – you know, have a bigger opportunity for a bigger title than maybe he would be able to get if he was to come to Texas. And this person said, hey man, trust me, it's not about the money with David Beatty. So I think this could be a situation where, you know, Texas could get him potentially in some kind of support staff role. It's, and you know, they wouldn't have, even if it was an on the field coach or a support staff role, I don't think, based on what I was told, Texas isn't going to have to throw a ton of money to get him. So the pieces just seem to work with his, you know, his knowledge, his knowledge of the conference, his offensive knowledge, his recruiting rep in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which Texas needs. So it just makes a lot of sense. But you bring up a good point. I don't think the financial aspect of it will be something that will be a deterrent for David Beatty if Texas wants to put him in a support staff kind of role.
Max, any final thoughts on this, or we can move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the one thing, and I think you make a good point that obviously we don't know who would be moving on for the Texas staff, if anybody, but, you know, David Beatty is the guy you'd want out on the road. You know what I mean? Ideally, you want him out recruiting in the DFW area. I mean, I think he's a stone cold killer in the Metroplex. He did it at A&M. And I think with if that guy's wearing Texas on his polo and going out in DFW, I think he would be a very productive recruiter for Texas. So if you can find a way to get him into an on-field role, don't know what kind of changes that would mean. I think that's probably the best thing for the program.
I'll just say it. I thought Derek Wareheim would have lost his job last year had there not been the addition of the 10th coaching spot, because Herb Hand was coming in one way or the other after Herman did his little audit of last year's team. David Beatty is a wide receivers coach. He's done it everywhere. He's an upgrade as a recruiter. He puts you in Dallas. It's not, it may not be fair, and I'm not saying it's a complete indictment of Derek Wareheim, but I think David Beatty's going to be coaching wide receivers on some level at Texas next year, and somebody's got to go for him to come in. And unfortunately for Wareheim, like, Beatty and Herman are boys, and I think that's going to matter. Moving on, second topic. This one is completely Texas OU centric. I am quite disappointed by the results because I really wanted to spend some time talking about Kyler Murray and Sam Ellinger, but that didn't win. There turned out to be a tie. The question of, is Lincoln Riley the new Mack Brown and is Tom Herman the new Bob Stoops? It received 32.9% of the vote. Tied with, can the Texas defense shut down or slow down the Oklahoma offense? So I went to Twitter and posted the poll there as a tiebreaker, and almost 80% of the audience polled wanted to talk about, can Texas slow down the Oklahoma offense? So our long 68, we'll start with you. Can the Texas defense slow down the Oklahoma offense?
I think we can. Of course, we've got to define in some ways slow down, I guess. If I got to use another analogy for sports, this is a tennis match where both guys have 130 mile an hour serves, and that's what their game is predicated on. And you just hope to get that one break. And so, and in this game, like they've talked about it before, a break could mean a field goal, holding them to a field goal as opposed to a touchdown, or maybe a real jewel of a stop and keeping them from scoring, or maybe getting a defensive score. I think we can, if you're thinking, but I'm not under any sort of illusions that we're going to hold them under 30 or even 35 points. But, I mean, if we can kind of keep them sort of what happened in October, that's probably going to be reasonable. I would think keeping them under 45 with this offense is in at least some ways appreciably slowing them down. And because I think we can keep up at that pace, but if they're just blowing our doors down and it's mid 50s or whatever, yes, it's going to be difficult. But I think we can slow them down enough to repeat what we did in October.
You make an interesting point, and I'll let Jason, Max, either one of you that want to jump in, feel free. Breaking serve, to use R. Long's metaphor, that was the difference in the West Virginia-Oklahoma game a week ago. Oklahoma broke serve with a couple of monster defensive plays, and it was the difference of the game. And when you look at Texas OU from October, Texas's ability to turn Kyler Murray over just a couple of times and the points they got off of those turnovers were the difference in the game. So does the question become, which defense is better served to break serve?
I think so. I think that's a good point.
Or which offense is easier to break? I mean, the simple answer is, can Texas slow down Oklahoma? No. The simple answer is no, you're not going to. You're not going to slow them down. I mean, they're going to get one of the best in the history of the college game. I've been thinking about, there are going to be meltdowns in the first quarter on Orange Bloods if Oklahoma, you know, has 150, 175 yards off. It's going to happen, man. Get ready for it, Orange Bloods. It's going to happen. What you have to hope is that Texas offense is up to the task of its own. You mentioned, I mean, breaking serve or whatever, however you want to, whatever it's going to be, but Texas has to. They're going to have a turnover or two like they did in the first game. I mean, if Oklahoma punts the ball three times in this game, I think they punt. I looked earlier, they punted three times in the first game. If you make Oklahoma punt three times, maybe even two, that's a win by the Texas defense in this game to me. I think Oklahoma's offense is that good. To me, it's not about – I mean, if you're going into this thing thinking, hey, we got to stop their offense, well, you're going to lose that battle. There's no way – Texas is going to stop that offense. I don't think Texas is going to have much success in slowing down that offense, which you have to hope if you're a Longhorn fan, which everybody listening to this will probably be, you have to hope that the Texas offense plays at an ultra high level, better than it certainly did last week, even than it did the past couple weeks. It's going to have to play at one of its best games of the year, just like it did the first time. It's going to have to be physical. The first meeting with Oklahoma I'm talking about, it's going to have to be physical. It's going to have to control the line of scrimmage. You're going to have, if you're Texas, you need to get a stop in the way of, you need Oklahoma to make a mistake, man. You need a turnover. Like Kyler made a couple mistakes in the first meeting. Texas needs that kind of thing. If you can hold, if you can get a mistake or two out of Oklahoma, force, I'm serious. I think maybe if you force two punts out of Oklahoma, that's a win in my book. Then Texas has a good chance to win this game. But you're not going to slow down that offense, man. They're going to put up huge points and huge stat numbers, yardage numbers. The Texas offense has to be up to the task of its own.
Yeah, I agree. And we got to keep in mind, too, Oklahoma has every reason to be chasing style points this week. Like, they're going to try to score 70 this week because they know that
absolutely
there's some possibility, probably a great one, that Ohio State on Saturday night is going to, you know, murder Northwestern and do everything they possibly can to make their best case for the committee, right? So you know that going in, that Ohio State is going to be doing everything they can to rack it up on Northwestern. So Oklahoma's going to go for the kill here. And obviously Kyler and Lincoln Riley want revenge in the worst way. So, you know, I think to your guys' point, like, you have to put it in simple terms here because the yards don't matter at all. The points don't matter. You just have to get stops. Like, they got six stops when they played them in October. They got six stops when they played them last year. And that gave them a chance both times. And, you know, I think that if you, like Jason said, if you can force three or four punts, you're in this game. That's all it's going to take. And, you know, Texas number five in the country in red zone defense, have gotten 12 stops in the red zone this season. If you can get one of those in this game, that's massive. You know, it's also on the other side because, look, you know, Sam throwing two interceptions last week. Like, Oklahoma's going to turn that into 14 points every time if you give them a short field. So Texas has to play clean. They can't give up easy points the way West Virginia did a week ago. And it you know, it bears mentioning that when it comes to getting stops, Oklahoma's defense is the worst in the Big 12 at doing this. They're worse than Baylor at getting stops this season. So, you know, you have to take advantage and score your points, but it's not going to take that many stops in this game to be playing with Oklahoma in the final minutes. If you can get six or more, you know, Texas can win this game.
I thought R. Long made a really good point when he just talked about defining what slowdown means. And I feel like we've spent the last couple of minutes talking about that, but that's under, I think, the October impression that Texas scored 48 points and kind of did what it wanted to do. And as Max points out, Texas, they weren't that offense a week ago because probably because Sam Ellinger wasn't completely healthy. He didn't play. He played his worst game of the season. And as everybody watched that game, it was impossible not to think ahead and say Texas has to be light years better next week than they were this week on that side of the ball. So when we look at, it's rather ominous for me going into this game that Tom Herman made a point very early to say, look, Sam's not going to be 100%. It's just going to be about the level of pain that he's able to play with. And I have a total lot of trust that he'll be fine. I don't know what percentage of Sam that Texas is getting this week, which means I don't know how to define exactly what slowdown truly needs to be, because I don't know if Texas is going to score 40 this week. I know as bad as Oklahoma is, the Texas offense just didn't look good last week. And I thought Kansas kind of gave a blueprint for what to do with Lil Jordan Humphrey and potentially how to treat the Texas passing game. And if I'm Oklahoma, and I realize we're kind of drifting off the topic a little bit, but I think the two were kind of intertwined together, I'm going to make Sam Ellinger beat me. I'm going to make him throw the ball down the field, which wasn't exactly something that he did very well beyond the first drive of the game on Friday against Kansas. So what do we think the point total needs to be for victory? And then, you know, I guess that is ultimately how we define slow down. If the point total's 50 and you got to keep them below 50, can they do that? Or is it more likely that the point total really and truly would need to be below 40? And then that becomes an interesting question, I think.
I mean, I think to your point, I think you're right. If it's, we're talking about banged up Ellinger, the important thing almost becomes how you play third down defense on your side of the field and how many field goals you can force, really, because that to me, like, that's the difference to some degree. Like when you watch Oklahoma, West Virginia, like Dana knew we are not kicking field goals in this game because there's no point. And so if Texas can, the more Texas can get Austin Seibert on the field, like the better off they are. And it's going to take a lot. It's going to take, because even when you're able to get him in third and eight, third and 10, third and longer, they're still going to have a play to beat you every time. So to me, it almost becomes, that becomes the battle. And, you know, if you're giving up seven every time, then you're putting so much pressure on Sam to do it too. And I think this is a much tougher week to ask that of him.
As far as point totals catch, Texas has to score 50. I feel pretty confident in saying that. I'm looking at Oklahoma's schedule here. Their last eight games, I think, here's their point total: 66, 45 in a loss to Texas, 52 at TCU, 51 against Kansas State, 51 at Tech, 48 Oklahoma State, 55 Kansas, 59 West Virginia. I mean,
Christ,
to think Texas is going to hold. I know, it's insane to think Texas is going to win this game by scoring 35, 38, 42. I don't see it. I mean, they won the first one on the last second field goal by scoring 48. You know, after Oklahoma kind of had some sluggish moments in that game, kind of midway through that game. But I think Texas has to get in the 50s to win this game. And like you said, after seeing what the performance they put on the field on Friday against Kansas, you got some concerns about Sam Ellinger's shoulder. Man, I just think it's going to be a tough task. But then again, as soon as I say that, then my brain reflects to how bad that Oklahoma defense is. So it's possible. It's not out of the question. But I just think Texas is going to need a big play in the way of a turnover, maybe a defensive score, maybe a special team score, something along that nature. But I think Texas has to get in the 50s because Oklahoma's going to – they're going to approach that 50 number. And Max's point, Oklahoma's going for the throat on this thing from the opening play. Anybody who says, hey, Oklahoma's not motivated, you know, I've seen people on our message board saying Oklahoma's not focused. Baloney, man. They've got everything to play for. They want to win this game for style points. They want to win it for revenge points. I mean, they're going to be motivated. They're going to be ready. Texas has to be up to the task. I think Texas is going to need 50 plus.
Hey, Max, last question on this, and I'll let everybody chime in. At the end of that West Virginia game, and it seemed like in big third down moments, West Virginia chose to drop eight and pray. And I feel like Kyler hasn't made a lot of mistakes this season, but he does not want to get hit. And I think that played, I think that revealed itself against Texas. I think he put the ball on the ground in part. He didn't want contact. Catching him, though, is easier said than done. It's not as simple as if you bring 5-6 guys and it doesn't get there. Oh, well, the downside to bringing pressure against him and it not working is either A, he still gets the pass completed and now there's space everywhere for his receivers to run, or you don't get home on the blitz and he finds his way outside of it and then he could go 75 on you. And it feels like teams get aggressive until he does that thing where he goes 75 and then they just drop eight and they forever pray that he'll just throw an incompletion, but it just doesn't happen very often. Because of what we've all agreed, which is you got to only stop them a couple of times. And if you can get them off the field three times without points, that might be enough. Don't you? I guess my philosophy would be that go after him. If you give up the big play, you give up the big play. But it's better to be aggressive and try to force him into a negative than to sit back and hope that he commits a negative.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the last play of that game in Morgantown. I mean, West Virginia, they dropped everybody. They said, we're going to cover the hell out of everybody you got out there. And they gave Kyler like 5 or 10 minutes to make a play, right? And he just scrambled around and found somebody with ease, right? And so, you know, I think that's a dangerous way to live, but you're right. I mean, it's dangerous both ways. I mean, I think a big part of it is you have to be able to just move on when you screw up. I mean, you had the play in the Cotton Bowl where there's one miscommunication and Marquise Brown is gone for 77 yards, right? So you have to be able to withstand that and just say, oops, and move on, because he's going to hit those. And you have to, I think you're right. I mean, I think the business decision thing is real. And I think it comes, I think it came up in the Cotton Bowl. I think it does again this week. And so you have to put That's pressure amazing. On him. You have to force him into doing things he doesn't want to do. And yeah, you're going to make mistakes on the back end sometimes, and it's going to turn into a big play, but I think you have to get him thinking. And I think Todd Orlando did a good enough job of that last time. But yeah, there's no doubt. If you're just going to drop eight, he's still going to find a way, or he's going to scramble. And he's also, when you get him stopped, he's going to take a bad play and make it great. I mean, you saw the one in October where they had two offensive linemen running into each other, and it should have been a blown up play, and he just ran right around it and broke his 67-yard touchdown run. So even when you get him trapped, he's still going to escape and make a big play, and you just have to be able to kind of move past it and get pressure on him next time.
Changing topics from the Texas defense and what it can and can't do against Oklahoma, moving to the third part of our discussion. It was national college football. The options were Mac Brown returns to North Carolina, the A&M LSU fallout, blah, 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 blah. Everybody wants to talk about Mac. Mac to UNC. Do you get it?
That's a great way to frame it. Like I don't. I mean, I think that it's fascinating to me that a big job like that is open and shut in 48 hours, and you're going out and hiring a guy that you've had before. I mean, the Scott Satterfields of the world are out there. You would think it's time for an up and comer there that can fix it. It's a good job. It's not a hard division, but you know, I think sometimes as we've seen this offseason, that nostalgia factor wins out. And to me, like, I think a little bit more confusing is just sort of like, you know, I understand how Mac Brown is going to approach this job. I mean, we all know the playbook that he has for building a program and for leading and what he and Sally are going to do there. But like, what is his why? You know what I mean? Like, why does he want to do this? He's literally going into the College Football Hall of Fame 1 week from now. And so, you know, what does he have to gain by doing this? Why can't these guys just sort of get out and stay out, right? I mean, he's been in the pressure cooker of this industry for 40 years and got out and had a very cushy life here for the past couple. Yet he admitted on Tuesday that he's been secretly interviewing for jobs this whole time and trying real badly to get back in. So I'm surprised, I guess, to some degree that Mac Brown wants to do it.
You know, that's a good question. The why, that's a good point, Max, a good question. I was actually talking to my dad about this yesterday, and to me, it's pretty simple. It's ego, man. I mean, these coaches, a lot of them have enormous egos. And I mean, listen, I mean, Mac's been on ESPN, national television. It's not like he's not getting a lot of the spotlight, but mm-hmm. you know, you can say it's competitive drive. That's part of it. But I think some of it is they just, their ego always tells them, hey, it's kind of like being an athlete. They can still do it. They can still get it done. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm fascinated by this whole story, and I'll be watching it closely, and I don't mind saying, I mean, I'll be rooting for him. I hope he does well. I have a lot of respect for him, but I have my concerns, if you will. I mean, does he still have the fire? Does he have the drive? He'll be 68 years old when the season kicks off next year. You know, that was kind of the big criticism in his last years at Texas, was the fire in his belly to get it done. Was it still there? I mean, is that fire suddenly reignited? I don't know. I'd be concerned about that if I'm North Carolina. And it was, you know, I was listening to some of the snippets from his press conference, and you know, you listen, you hear Mac talk, and he's working the room, and you kind of remember, like, gosh, now it comes back to me why he's such a good recruiter and why he, you know, did so well at Texas. But then I start hearing some of the same jokes and some of the same things, and I'm thinking, okay. And then I remember off a little bit there at the end, Mac. You know, I mean, when I say freshen things up, times have changed, man. The game has changed. Recruiting has obviously changed. Mac mentioned, okay, he's gonna have to figure out this whole, how to deal with this whole early signing period. Well, that's a small part of it, man. I mean, you know, using a bigger and better support staff, leaning on those guys, graphics departments and edits, and just the way you have to handle these recruits. And social media obviously has changed recruiting in a monumental way over the last few years. It's a whole different ball game. The stuff away from the field is a whole different ball game than what Mac ever dealt with when he was at Texas. So he is going to have to kind of, at 67 years old, he's going to have to change his stripes. He's going to have to lean heavily on his support staff and his assistant coaches, but it's a whole different game. I'll be fascinated to see if Mac can make the kind of adjustments that need to be made to be successful in today's college football world. I don't know, man. I'm rooting for him. I'm going to be watching closely. To me, it's one of the more interesting, I'd say, and not just next year. I'm not just talking about on the field. I'm watching like day one, how he's going to finish in recruiting leading up to early signing period, leading up to February. I'll be watching this one closely. I have a real interest in this one. I hope he does well. I have a lot of respect for Mac. I want to see him succeed, but he's going to have to make some changes. I just don't know that it's the perfect fit, but it'll be interesting one way or another.
Being the Mac historian that you are, I would love to hear your take on this.
So I think this story goes back basically 10 years, not quite to the date, but pretty close. If you go back to when Will Muschamp was named the head coach in waiting, I think the way that thing happened in the very beginning was, I think Mac was surprised and a little caught off guard by everybody's reaction to it, their perception of it. I don't think he mentally was ready for it. But then I think in that first offseason after Muschamp was named the head coach in waiting, I think he liked it. I think that suddenly Muschamp got to be the face of recruiting and got to do a lot of the heavy lifting, and Mac got to be the head coach without all of the responsibilities. And I think it worked really well in 2009. And Mac kind of, you know, they were so successful on the season. They were having that great 2-year run. And there was some thought that if Texas had beaten Alabama in the national championship game, that Mac would have rode off into the sunset and legitimately had that moment that so few people in this industry have, which is kind of the John Elway farewell, that you go out on top and you live happily ever after. So what happens? They don't win that game. 2010 rolls around. It's a complete disaster. In the middle of that season, everybody remembers the infamous stories of Mac meeting with his assistant coaches and essentially saying, "I can't believe you've done this to me." And he throws them all under the bus. The Texas assistant coaches are furious behind the scenes that Mac has been AWOL throughout the entire offseason. They put it in their hands, and now that it's not working, now he's coming in. So he gets rid of everybody after the 2010 season, and he starts all over. And he didn't do a bad job. They just weren't great teams, but there was some good coaching mixed in. Texas wins 8 games and 9 games, but they have the monstrosities on defense against BYU. He has to fire Diaz, all this stuff. He has to bring back in Greg Robinson, and ultimately he loses his job. From the moment that the 2010 season happened following the national championship game, I felt like Mac was chasing the perfect send-off moment that he thought he was going to have, and then it never happened. And I think more than ego about he has to be, have his name in the limelight and that there's this urge to be, I don't know, this alpha male that we see these coaches kind of get off on. It's impossible for some of them to leave the game because there's so much power and there's so much control and the competitive juices are flowing. I think Mac is chasing something that I don't know he can get his hands around anymore. However, I think it would be cool if he could finally beat Florida State. So that would be cool. Like, he's never done that before.
He's got a good chance.
Exactly. And the other thing is, North Carolina is coming off wretched back-to-back seasons. If Mac, let's say Mac's there for 3 years and 3 years only, but he wins eight, and let's say he wins 10 or 9, and they go to a decent bowl game. I think, whereas at Texas, that would be viewed as a failure. I think at North Carolina, because I don't think North Carolina is thinking to themselves, we got to make the hire that beats Clemson. I think North Carolina is thinking, we got to get back to 8-9 wins and just having people interested. And I think if that's the measure of success and Mac is okay with that kind of outline measure of success, I could actually see this working because I don't think Mac's going to fail the way that Charlie failed at Texas or the way ultimately Larry Fedora failed at North Carolina. I just think we have to view this through the prism of that national championship team. Vince Young ain't ever walking through that door again, and probably neither is Colt McCoy, and probably is neither that thing that he had at Texas.
Well, Jeff, I watched the press conference yesterday, and like, I don't think he used the word championships once. I think that the circumstances there are pretty favorable overall. Like, if you look at that coastal division they're in, they had five teams go 7-5 this year, and one of them was Pitt, who won the division. So, like, I agree with you. I don't think Mac Brown was hired to topple Clemson. He's just being brought in to try and win the division, and I don't think that's that hard of an ask in that division. You have to, you know, you're going to deal with Virginia Tech and Miami every year, but they both went, you know, they both had down years this year and went 500 in conference play. So in some ways, like, I think you're totally right. He's walking into such a good situation that if you can just go win 8-9 games, then job well done.
Yeah. And let's be honest. If you're looking at Mac Brown's career, if North Carolina is somehow bringing him in to say, hey, we want to get to the top of our conference, clearly Mac is really not that coach. Okay, yes, I understand he had the national title and the two Big 12 titles, but let's keep it real. Those are the only two conference titles he had. And in 16 years at Texas, he was always number two at best, previously in the ACC. So if you're bringing him in with the illusion that, hey, we're going to get to the top of the ACC, I think it's a bad hire. Now, if they're saying, look, let's get him in, let's just take up the minds of our fan base until basketball season starts, let's get 8-9 wins, I think it's reasonable that he can perhaps turn a couple of those out. Another thing I'm concerned about is some people are saying, well, I think of just bringing him in for 3 years, then he can hand the job off. We saw the inability previously of Mac to hand the job off to somebody. Has he changed? Perhaps he has, but if that's the reason for the hire, then I don't know exactly how based in reality that is. I also truly believe, and I think Ketch will back this up, his recruiting, that 13 season was starting to leak oil. And that 2014 class, obviously Charlie finished that class out with only about 4 weeks left, so that really is Mac's class. That 14 class would have been an utter disaster in terms of Mac Brown standards. But it started to leak oil in 13. It was coming off the track in 14. It's just a different ballgame. He's not at Texas. He's not in his recruiting prime. I think he can probably get more than his share of three-star types, but you know, I don't know how much recruiting prowess he's going to be able to do in a 2-3 maybe 4 year span.
Well, I mean, that's a great point. I wonder if it's not recruiting that ultimately was the thing that made, because I think Bob Stoops loves coaching football. I just wonder if he loves all of the rest of it. And then what made Lincoln Riley such an attractive guy for Oklahoma, and what I think makes Tom Herman such an attractive guy for Texas, is they love the recruiting component. And the Mac Brown of 1998, like, I don't think Texas fans realize how good Mac himself was in the prime, when he could go into a living room and just close it. And he had such an appetite for it. You know, he did a good job in his final years of adjusting and hiring support staff and bringing in, I thought, really quality guys. There are times I wake up, and I'm 42 years old, and there are times I wake up and I think, and I work all day, and I think to myself, today's the day I'm going to get everything done. And if it means I'm going to stay up till 2 a.m. and squeezing an extra 4 to 6 hours of work in, then so be it. It has to be done. And then by 10 o'clock at night, I've worked all day, but then my kids have gotten home and I'm just tired. Like, I don't want to stay up till 2. I don't want to do personally the extra 6 hours of work, and I'll just do it tomorrow. And I think to be successful in college football coaching, you can't have that attitude that I have when my kids make me tired, where it's like, I think I'm just going to go to bed. Like, you have to plow through it. And I think the Mac at the end of Texas, I think he wanted to plow through it. But I think that, you know, you get to a point where you just don't perform at the level that you used to perform at. And I'm fascinated to see how long this lasts, because Mac is 67. Coach, you know, Bill Snyder pulls it off to some degree because he's Bill Snyder. But this is typically where we start to point at Bobby Bowden and think to ourselves, he needs to get out of this. And we do that with everybody. Mac in theory will be coaching into 70, something that I never thought would happen in a million years. And the other thing is, Max, he's really good at TV. Like, he's a Hall of Fame coach. I think he's a better, I think if he did announcing for 20 years, we would look at Mac the way he'd be Lee Corso on steroids. Like, he's so good. I'm really surprised that he's giving that up, because Mac loves to be told nice things. And I think everybody loves him as an announcer. And it's really weird for me to see him walk away from something that everybody universally acclaims him for.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think also, like, to the recruiting piece, and I think you guys make great points, like, the bar is very, very low right now in North Carolina. Like, they have the number 13 class in the ACC.
wow.
44 of the top 50 recruits in their state are committed right now. And the only guy who's committed to UNC is number 50 on that list, right? So Mac Brown can walk in there, and they don't have a single four-star guy in their class. Like, so Mac Brown can walk in there and do a pretty good job of recruiting and greatly improve them. You know what I mean? And in some ways, Mac is going to be kind of comfortable in that circumstance, because, I mean, you know how it is at Texas, where he's trying to lock down the borders. Like, they've had Dexter Lawrence and Will Greer and Bryce Love and all these All-American kind of guys leave the state. I mean, Clemson and all these schools have been raiding the state. Like, Mac can kind of handle that deal. But at the same time, it's all about who he surrounds himself with. You know what I mean? I think it's the coordinator hires, and he's not hiring Cliff Kingsbury as his OC. That's a joke. That's not going to happen. But if he can hire some folks and delegate to them like he always does and let them run the program, kind of like the Herm Edwards deal at Arizona State, like, I kind of think they'll be fine. But I'm with you, Jeff. Like, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to the idea that, you know, when Colt got injured against Alabama, that probably set in motion where we're at today with Mac, where he's still sort of chasing, you know, one final kind of being carried off the field moment. And it just never got to happen at the end of Texas there. And, you know, it would be a comfortable, easy move to stay put at ESPN. I'm sure he was making some nice coin there, but for some reason, like Jason said, like, these guys, they just have to, like, they have to feel like they're the hero at all times, and these jobs are great at providing that.
Well, I'll be rooting for Mac.
Me too. To the point about what he's chasing and maybe wanting to get a last ride off the field, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to that. Keep in mind, the last time he walked off the field for a Texas squad was that Alamo Bowl beat down by Oregon, where him and Sally just looked like they'd been put through the ringer. I mean, I think the final score was, what, 30-7 or whatever. It was just a horrible game. And you know, I guess that was the last moment he had walking off as the head coach at the University of Texas. And so maybe that is the windmill, so to speak, that he's chasing or going after. I don't know. But as long as Carolina's got reasonable expectations, it can be a good hire for them. I just hope they're not trying to get over their skis too much, but I guess we'll see.
I'd give a penny to know Sally's thoughts on this, but we need to move on. We've got one final topic to kind of wrap this thing up quickly so that it doesn't go on forever. The winning final topic was each of our most important 2019 Texas recruit as it relates to making a first year impact in the 2019 season. Sukumel, I'm putting it on a tee for you. Who's your guy?
You know, I thought about this a little bit this morning. I kind of have two answers. If I know little Jordan Humphrey was leaving, my guy is going to be Jake Smith, the Rivals 100 wide receiver. I think he can bring an element to this offense that, frankly, just Texas doesn't have and hasn't had in a while. DeSean Jameson kind of provides a little bit of that, but he's not a natural receiver the way Jake is. I mean, Jake Smith can line up as a running back. They can do jet sweeps of them. He's a pure slot receiver, but he is a guy that can take the top off a defense in a variety of ways and score from anywhere on the field. He can do it in special teams. So Jake Smith would be my guy on offense if Lil Jordan Humphrey's gone. If not, Jacoby Jones is an easy one to say. He's a JUCO guy. You bring those guys in early. But I'll tell you, I think DeGabriel Floyd, the linebacker, I think he has a chance to come in. He's enrolling early, tremendous talent. He's physically pretty well developed for a young man his age. Texas is going to need some help at the linebacker position next year, clearly. I think DeGabriel Floyd has a chance to be an impact player for Texas as a true freshman. So both sides of the ball there. I'll go Jake Smith on offense. I'll go Gabe Floyd on defense. Give me Gabe Floyd, unless LJ leaves, then give me Jake. How about that? I'm hedging my bets a little bit, as I usually do.
Arlong's thinking that's a very Sukumel answer. Arlong, what about you?
You know, I'm going to disagree. I'm only a slight disagreement on the caveat that Sukumel threw out there. Even if Humphrey stays, by all accounts, Smith is dynamic with the ball coming in. And if you look at the elite programs, take, for example, Alabama and Percy Waddle. I mean, obviously, Alabama's got terrific receivers, but Waddle's been able to come in and have an impact, even if you just say on special teams. So I think you get it. This is an offense that still needs some explosive players. I think Smith can bring that. If Free is back, perhaps his touches might be a little bit limited, but I still think you can find ways to get him the ball, and then particularly on special teams. And, of course, it may allow Jameson, it sounds like, perhaps to slide back over to the defensive side, which will sort of be a good domino effect. So I'm going to say Jake Smith with no caveat, whether Humphrey stays or goes. At a minimum, the top recruit on offense, if we're going to pick one and one, I'll pick Floyd also on defense. And, of course, this is subject to change depending on how we finish, but I think those are two strong freshmen that I think the majority of the fan base are would sort of point to as, hey, they can be impact guys next season. I'm excited to see Jake Smith on offense. I really am. I just want to see a guy come in, be able to get that ball in his hands and really, you know, whether special teams or on offense, just create problems that we normally find ourselves trying to defend against.
Max, I'm going to just make sure that you know this exists, this possibility. You can go with anybody, even if they're uncommitted. I'm a little surprised that we haven't heard, well, if Brew McCoy commits or if you can get this guy or that guy. Everybody's kind of stuck to the commitment list. When you pick your guy, I just want you to know you can go in any direction you want.
Yeah, I mean for sure, Brew McCoy, if they can get him, and obviously I think what's going on at USC this week probably helps them more than it hurts them. He would just be, in terms of how they use him, I think would be a lot of fun to watch next year. Honestly, I'll give you the boring answer, though. I do think it's DeGabriel Floyd, because you just look at this team, and bottom line, I mean, you're losing, I think, 8 starters on defense. You're going to need new leadership. Because really, I mean, think about it. It's Brandon Jones. It's Caden Stearns. It's, you know, who else? I guess Malcolm Roach. Who are your dudes really leading that group? So you need some guys that can come in and just be dudes from day one. And I think clearly there's a need for a badass linebacker. So I think it's DeGabriel Floyd. I think him and Daylight need to, I think, really be guys that they can really rely on next year and who can grow quickly. So I think he's the guy. I think that you know, should be very excited about what he can bring, especially to get him in for spring. And, but I'm with you guys. I'm excited to see Jake Smith, you know, carry on the Shipley tradition too. That's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
I'm going to go against the grain with everybody except Sukumel, who once upon a time, 5 minutes ago, said the easy answer would be Jacoby Jones.
Yeah.
When I look at next year, I see, look, the starters are all gone, and suddenly you're left with Gerald Wilbon in the middle, and you've got Taquan Graham, and you've got Marquez Bimage, and a lot of, and then those guys are unproven, and there's a lot, everything else behind them is kind of unproven. So when you look at a JUCO guy, sometimes it takes a year to, I mean, Gary Johnson didn't hit the ground running. Most JUCO guys don't, but given the need, I'm going to say Jacoby Jones, even if I know a first year impact is kind of a coin flip proposition at best, no matter how highly recruited they are. They need him to be good. And so I'm going to point to him less out of he's the best guy in this class and more out of every position on the field they need immediate help from the most. I think the front seven on defense is obvious. And so, you know, I think Floyd's he's a good answer, but my biggest concerns are on the defensive line. And so I'll pick the guy that I think has the best chance to come in and immediately help a group that I think is going to need help. And any final thoughts on that?
Real quick on Jacoby, I'm looking back through my old notes and I need to follow up with him. First time I talked to him, this was back in May. I'm looking back from my old notes, but he has 2 years to play too. So he doesn't have a redshirt year either. So, I mean, he's going to play. Okay. I mean, unless he's just terrible when he gets to Austin, he's going to play. So it's not like, you know, you don't have a redshirt year. Maybe sometimes you see that with guys, they've done it with Jamar Chisholm and a couple other JUCO guys. I mean, Jacoby Jones is coming in, you know, unless you're going to waste that scholarship, he's coming in to play next year. So he'd be a good answer, but, whatever, I'll stick to my Jake / the Gabriel Floyd answer.
He's also an interesting guy because Texas seems to have recruited California JUCOs well, I guess, yeah. Right? In the context of how Texas has recruited JUCOs only in the last couple of years. They've gone into Mississippi. They've never really been able to crack into the Kansas JUCO market with success. So this will be an interesting to watch just because – they have so few guys with that background. And if you're going to get JUCOs, Max, you would agree with me. I think that the Kansas JUCO market is, and there's a reason why Bill Snyder has been able to live off of that kind of pipeline, that Texas is in that is a big deal, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. And plus, you know, he was committed to Oklahoma. So any chance Texas has to make Oklahoma worse, I think is pretty important too. Right.
Yeah, and given that they play each other this week, I think my answer wins because it's a middle finger to the Sooners. Max, thank you. Arlong, thank you. Jason, as always, thank you. This has been the Pigskin Plinko episode number 2. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.